Hello, everybody. Welcome to Portal to Ascension Radio. This is your host, Neil Gore, aka MC Resonance. Thank you so much for being here and a part of our series. We've been going pretty strong. We're over 60 episodes now in the series. And what I'm doing right here is this is going to be a new chapter in the evolution of our podcast, right? So hopefully some of you have been able to stay with us and see the last 60 plus episodes. If you haven't, go back in the archives. We have some incredible information. But since we do so many events on Portal to Ascension, we have the opportunity to get interviews and perspectives on all types of topics from so many different people. So what you're going to be experiencing now are going to be interviews from our last Portal to Ascension conference that took place in May of 2021. So we're going to be launching another 20 to 25 different interviews from some amazing presenters, everything from panels on UFO disclosure to experiencers to information about ancient civilizations and sites to UFOs to evolution of consciousness to the cycles of time. So a lot of great information here. So much information that it's going to be truly profound. I hope that you can stick around and tune into as many of these podcasts as possible and do share it, because what we're attempting to do is grow our Portal to Ascension Radio as its own independent avenue of releasing conscious content. So if you can come back here, share it with your friends and family, and then also, you know, take part of it and listen and tune into the information, that'd be incredibly great. You can also check us out on many other platforms. The best thing to do really is to just search engine Portal to Ascension, add everything you can find. But do go to youtube.com/portal to Ascension and subscribe to our channel there, or you can check us out on Patreon and get exclusive bonuses at patreon.com/portal to ascension. And of course, we're on Facebook and other social platforms as well. So let's go ahead and get into this, guys. We're going to go into our series. You're going to hear me saying the same words at the beginning of every single interview for the upcoming couple of weeks, and then I'll do a little outro. But the meat of everything, the meat of every single podcast will be a different speaker, a different topic, and many other guests with great, great inspirational messages for you. So let's get into it.
Yeah. So, Neil, do you want to just give a little background about what the connection between Portal to Ascension is and ancient civilizations?
Oh, man. Yes, I would love to, actually. So, you know, I have this three major topics that Portal to Ascension really covers, which really covers a lot of other topics within it. But it would be, of course, evolution of consciousness, extraterrestrials and UFO information, and then ancient history and true world history. And the true world history component is amazing because it actually ties into all of that, the evolution of consciousness, whether we're talking about the cycles of time and the ages, or that over years and centuries or whatever, we're evolving in consciousness. And when it comes to ETs, we're of course talking about our ancient history and not only their influence and maybe the interaction with humanity on this planet, but also what is our galactic origins, where we came from. So that's why a lot of our events, in almost every single event, even if it's like a UFO disclosure conference, we'll have two or three ancient civilizations researchers on there. And even when we do sound healing events and workshops, where half of those workshops are completely dedicated to how sound and vibration was used in ancient history. I do feel that we, since we have amnesia on this planet, most of us do anyway, that, and not only that, educational institutes are not teaching us a true history, that we don't even know half the picture really of, you know, of the depth of our ancestry, of humanity, how advanced we've been in the past, who we really were, and the mistakes we made and how we can shift them, because the evidence and the information is out there about the things that we did in the past. Whether it's maybe nuclear war, maybe it's something else, maybe it's the devolution and mistakes that we made within politics that led to our demise. All of these components, I feel, will soon one day be out there for the world to know. And when we get re-educated with this information, it will give us a depth of knowledge about our antiquity of humanity, but it will also allow us to have information so that we can create a beautiful future for ourselves. And that's why we need to always have this component of exploring our ancient history. Alan, shall we begin?
Yes. So what I say is that the Portal to Ascension is really showing us a new heaven and a new earth. We're exploring the heavens with new ideas about civilization and the cosmos, and we're exploring the Earth and its past because it's time we know the truth of our origin. So that's why I'm really happy about today's panel, because these are scholars of ancient civilizations that we have here today, including my good friend sitting next to me, Dr. J.J. Hertog and Dr. Desiree Hertog. And I know Manu Safzada, right, Manu, who just wrote a book. He's completed, I think it's called Under the Sphinx, which is a new understanding of the real face, the real meaning of the Sphinx and its original form as a lioness over the Hall of Records. I also know Paul Wallace is and understands the ancient Egyptian cosmologies and dynasties. I know a little bit about you. You also read hieroglyphics, don't you, Paul?
Oh, I wish I did. Oh, you may be confusing me with a cleverer Paul.
Maybe.
But, please go ahead.
But what is your background in ancient civilizations?
Well, I came to ancient civilizations via my studies in the Hebrew canon. And that's really where my journey onto all this territory began. And as I extended my studies out from there, I got quite quickly to Plato. Mm-hmm. And I realized that Plato tied together all these different aspects of origins. And he was answering the question, where are we? What's going on? Where's all this come from? And in his writings, he addressed the question of, where's this civilization come from? And so he talks about previous civilizations. He got that knowledge from the Egyptians. And then he talked about, well, where did we come from as a species? And so he talked about the extraterrestrial intervention in our evolution. And then he asked the question, well, where did our consciousness come from? Surely our visitors didn't invent consciousness. And so he gets to the territory that Mark finished with today, talking about the evolution of the cosmos itself and the journey of consciousness from the beginning to today. So by the time I got to Plato, I realized all these things are connected.
Yes.
And you can't study one and not transgress onto the other.
Exactly. Thank you for being here. I also want to introduce Omar, who's also very knowledgeable in cosmologies of the past and multidimensional realities. What would you say the source of your knowledge is, Omar? Unmute. That's it. Ancient civilizations.
I would have to say that my journey, when it began a very, very long time ago, it was in the 90s, but I really didn't fully understand what was going on in my mind until about mid-2000s. And it was about in the mid-2010s, about 7 years ago, I began Watcher's Talk and began interviewing authors and researchers like we have on the screen here. And then from them, I really began to learn everything about our ancient history, Atlantis, Lemuria, root races, things like that, what's happening in South America, who built the pyramids all around the world, the spheres and things like that. So really my knowledge is really based off of everyone that I've interviewed, hundreds of people over the course of last, 7 years. So, I've been really, grateful to all the people that I've interviewed that have given me this knowledge.
It's incredible knowledge I think the world should know about. That's why I will just talk to Neil for a second. Neil, I know you, this is one of your, not hobbies, but passions. How do you fit the whole cosmology of ancient civilizations into where we are today?
So the reason why I started doing Portal to Ascension or even getting into consciousness was because I wanted to find the root of all religion. I was raised Hindu. I just did what I was told. And I was just curious when I started discovering around 18 years old, when I was in 2000, 17, 18 years old, when I started discovering that a lot of ancient civilizations had the same exact stories, but religions, right? Religious scriptures had the same exact stories, but they were always concentrating on what made them so different. But then no one was really exploring the fact that there were these similarities in stories and why do they have the similarities? What is the root of all of that? So organized religion seemed to be pushing the differences to me. That made me start wondering, okay, so what is the origin of humanity? If I got to track back religion, and most of the events, like I would say a good like
like 500 events I ever did was literally designed, especially in the early times, to track back our history to see if there was an original race or original religion that basically dissipated and, I mean, just spread around the whole entire planet. And as I was doing that, you know, I've been researching all different elements when, in regards to, for example, the history of the Russian Eastern European area for the last 3,000 years. I've been spending the last 6 months researching the tribes and the migration routes and all that, and just trying to figure out different areas of the world and what their origins are to see if they go back to a common tribe. And as I was doing that, I really thought I one day could actually create a presentation called The Root of All Religion. And as I did it, I created a presentation called Origin Stories instead. That was a 4-hour presentation on 180 different origin stories and the similarities with them. And so all I've come to understand now is that the more I look into the ancient history, the more questions there are, because there's so many different tribes that migrated and mingled with each other. For us to just come up with a blanket statement based on this tribe did this tribe mingled here and brought the culture there, it's such a minimal component to the story that it's really difficult to figure out the entire picture. Well, but that does pique my curiosity, though. Yeah, go ahead.
I want to really put some of those pieces together with the scholars.
Yes.
Researchers that we have here today. I want to start with Dr. J.J. Hertog, who spent probably 50 years or more studying ancient civilizations, cuneiform, Chinese.
I studied at the Orly Institute, University of Chicago, with Mircea Eliade, a Romanian Orientalist, Norman Gobe, a Hebrew scholar on the Dead Sea Scrolls, Klaus Baer, Egyptologist, Desiree, my wife, and I, as linguist social scientists, have done several expeditions in Egypt, in Israel, in the Far East, and looking basically at the historic footprint of where we have come from as a species.
And Neil is exactly right, because basically they're all united in some way. We were just looking at the Nazca uniqueness. Some people tie in the Nazca to Angkor Wat, which originally was a Hebrew temple that talks about really the whole churning of the Sea of Milk. And this is, of course, also a little bit of an extraterrestrial conference. And if you look at the churning of the Sea of Milk in ancient Hindu, you see these strange beings on one side of the serpent pulling, and the other side you have, we'll say, Krishna-like forms. And I think this is part of the cosmology that is out there. You have the duality that exists in different in our space, and that these temples are trying to bridge and create the Trinity power or the sacred power
behind space, time, and spirit
behind the duality. And so that's what, you know, a lot of these sacred areas, like the Great Pyramid, did as well. Now, one of the things we were actually one of the preliminary people that discovered the tomb of Osiris on the Giza Plateau, which is 100 feet down. And that was really interesting to realize. We even don't even think it's necessarily a tomb. It was a name given to it by Zahi Hawass. But we really think that some of these temples are sound frequency temples, like Tikal is known as a music place of sound, or other places were literally energy places.
In short, we use ground penetrating radar and acoustical measuring devices to find underground places, areas of tombs, underground tunnel systems, both in Egypt as well as in Yucatan. And we began to look at the geometric relationship with acoustical physics generated by certain sounds that the ancients would use as a way of raising consciousness.
And to reflect the harmony of the spheres, though I think the word temple means reflection of the stars, template, temple. And so these ancient sites were bringing us in contact with what was above us, as above, so below. And that was really the function of temples, to bring us into a kind of cosmic consciousness. And that's what you do when you enter the sacred chambers. The consciousness switches from the worldly or the secular to the holy, to the essential. So I want to just talk to Manu, because he goes back to ancient Egypt and he traces the development of the ancient culture, ancient civilization in Egypt, and talks about really the significance of the Sphinx as a lioness as its connection to the constellation Leo, and as Robert Bavall says, the belt stars of Orion were very key in developing the whole Giza Plateau. So Manu, unmute yourself and talk about where you think the significance of the Egyptian culture is in relationship to world culture and how it's important to us today, if that's not too much. Okay. Wait, unmute. Manu, we don't want to miss a word. I have to unmute your mic. Please,
Mute. Okay. Is there it unmuted? Okay. Sorry about that. Yeah, I was reading your book, Alan, this morning, actually, Making Contact, and there was something that struck me that kind of was your epiphany when you read James Joyce and his streaming consciousness, right? So this is kind of a good bridge for me to talk about Edgar Cayce and Under the Sphinx, because interestingly, Edgar Cayce basically was said that he was tapping into the Akashic records, which is sort of the same idea, right? You have this universal.
Right. I just want to say that quote by James Joyce is like, "Welcome alive. I am here to bring forth the consciousness of my race as an artist." This is what James Joyce. So yeah.
Right. And so I was drawing a connection to the Akashic records from which Edgar Cayce was tapping into when he was in this dreamlike state. And so that takes me to the portal of ascension. So essentially, the ancient Egyptians built a physical portal to ascension in the pyramids, right? When they made the pyramids and they wrote the pyramid texts into those walls, they actually created a chamber next to the burial chamber. And on the walls of that chamber were hymns and spells, basically, that were to assist the king how to ascend to heaven. And when you then read the coffin text, where this the earthly aspect of this is more expanded, that's when you learn how they conceptualized this. So they were actually talking about a skill that the spirit had to acquire in the underworld, in the netherworld, in order to be able to ascend to the sky, to the cosmos, and then attain immortality. And that is, if you will, that's in essence sort of what Edgar Cayce was talking about. He was basically tapping into these records, but he's saying that anybody can do this, but if you don't do it in a skillful manner, you might get the wrong idea. This is what Edgar Cayce was saying in his readings. He was saying that you have to have a certain clairvoyant skill in order to filter the records and extract only those that are true and not the negative experiences or the positive. In other words, the part of the records that are tainted by your subjectivity. And so this is the same concept basically in what it meant to be equipped in the pyramid text and the coffin text. So when you were equipped as a spirit, that is when only then were you able to ascend through this portal, which is physically recreated in the pyramids, to be able to ascend to the sky.
Which is what JJ did when he tone the sacred names. There was a portal that opened and he had to be at a high enough level of consciousness to know if it was right or not.
Right. So we agree wholeheartedly with what you said. And actually, so not only is it the shape of the geometry, which really we could spend a whole program on the mathematics behind the Great Pyramid, but also when we use sound vibrations in those chambers, you get really, we got light effects. And this is really, Dr. This, Jack, you want
we
to
were
say?
Using ancient Hebrew Egyptian sound combinations, mm-hmm. and suddenly there was this light burst inside the Grand Gallery of the Great Pyramid.
Yeah, this is the Grand Gallery. It's a photograph of the Grand Gallery. When they were doing light frequencies, it lit up. Mm-hmm. And so
we've also shown when we were in the King's Chamber, we actually had lots of orbs, very unique orbs that were also present. So, and we've noticed, because we did this research, we actually did sound testing, official sound testing, both in Egypt and also, here's the orbs, and also in Mexico. And what we notice is if they repaired the structure in Mexico the wrong way with different stones, you lost the sacred vibration. So the sounds, the geometry. And then I want to just add something that Alan mentioned. The passageway was literally to Orion. This is something also Dr. Hertak had in his book in the
20 years before Robert Bavall.
In the 70s. that we basically went into and through the constellation Orion. We now know we are on the Orion arm of the Milky Way, and we believe that that is our position for a reason. And in addition to that, right now we're sitting in near Hobie Land, and they have
Arizona,
and they have the main three mesas: first mesa, second mesa, third mesa. This is a sacred natural phenomena, but actually some people have aligned that with the three stars of the belt of Orion, similar to what Bavel said, because Dr. Hurtak actually in his book felt that these, we'll say, the air shafts or the stargates, star paths, go into Orion. But what Bavel was unique in is he said, well, the three pyramids themselves are connected with Orion. We also look at the pyramids of Mexico City, of the Aztecs, the Teotihuacan, and we notice that there's the pyramid of the moon, the pyramid of the sun, but also the pyramid of Quetzalcoatl, and they're very similar in alignment to what you find there. Most people just hear about the moon and the sun. They don't realize about Quetzalcoatl is a major pyramid. That, to me, is the great pyramid of the Aztecs.
So we work with musicologists and specialists who are working with NASA and Star Trek, who had a keen musical ear to know the difference between white noise, a pink noise, and actual sounds that could vibrate a paraphysical energy form.
Well, I want to talk to Paul for a second about how it all fits into your cosmology, what you put together from the ancient Hebrew texts, Plato, the Greeks, and beyond. Does this fit into sort of your research, Paul?
Oh, increasingly so. And as I say, the thing that tied it together for me was the knowledge that Plato had, and it was Plato who really signaled to me that there was a knowledge of previous civilizations that was vested in ancient Egyptian knowledge. So this is why I'm loving being here today, because I'm absolutely sitting at your feet listening to this, because I know this is a direction that's been pointed to me. But that was really the portal that opened for me. All the knowledge that Plato had curated, which he had pulled together from Egyptian sources, but also from experiments in consciousness. And I don't know if I was ever told that when I went through theological college, because my training was in theology for Christian ministry, and that was my career for 33 years. And of course, we had to touch on Plato because he's so foundational to Christianity, albeit he lived four centuries before. But I don't remember my reading as a student understanding that some of his information came from a psychedelic tea. I don't think that got emphasized, but he was unashamed to say that it was, if I can say, experiments in consciousness that allowed him access to information that came from other dimensions. And
well, the Eleusinian mysteries were about higher consciousness. So,
yes, exactly. That's right. And of course, Plato is writing in the name of Socrates. And so he sort of says, well, this he gives the idea this was Socrates' experience. However, I think his description of the Eleusinian mysteries and the information that came from them is so internalized. I'm absolutely convinced Plato's talking about his own. His own Kaikion ceremony.
Paul, if I can jump in here, there used to be in the Middle Ages a prayer to Socrates, O Socrates, ora pro nobis. Holy Socrates, pray for us. That's how relevant the rediscovery of Socrates was to medieval monks. But having studied the Nag Hammadi text in Coptic, there is one called Asclepius, where Asclepius tells the reader that Egypt was once the schoolhouse of the gods.
And yes, indeed.
The schoolhouse of the gods has become a place of tombs. The gods have fled back to the heavens, to quote the text, which means that Egypt was more than just a land of interesting monuments. It was a place of study that attracted Homer, Pythagoras, the great minds of the Hellenistic traditions, as well as the Hebraic, as well as the other peoples of importance throughout the entirety of the Middle East.
Well, I want to say
in that text, just while we're on it, in that text, it talks about the loss of all that knowledge. It sort of prophesies the loss of all that knowledge. And we know through history, that knowledge was deliberately shut down through the orthodoxization of the empire.
I just want to say about Socrates, I don't know if he did psychedelics, but he also was a mystic. He would look at the daemon. He'd go into a trance just on his own. And even when he was in prison, when he was given the death sentence by the Athenians, he was having visions of the divine mother, the divine feminine coming to him. So he was always on that higher level. And people don't recognize, even though he's the father of Western philosophy, which is very kind of linear, he was on this other level that we have to start to bring back. But I don't want to get into...
Well, yeah, if you think of Pythagoras, for example, the father of geometry and the way we create structures now, he was completely into that as well, like on another level of consciousness. And just like just a little bit of research into him just shows you that he was actually dealing with harmonics and frequencies, you know? And so it's interesting that a lot of these things that became linear sciences that kind of molded the modern world that we're in, the people that originated them were at this level of consciousness that we're exploring right now.
Yeah, they were mystical elements.
Right. And I was going to say the Hopis actually, they used to have communication directly with the Kachina star people. This is part of their legend. And then at a certain time, they decided it wasn't, they weren't to stay here. And even Osiris, if you go back to the legends, he taught around the world through music. I think that's such a beautiful analogous, but that's what it says in the legends, that he taught the world through music. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, of course, you know, he's no longer on the planet. So I think the ancient history really was this contact experience with higher realms of intelligence, whether it was through divine awareness or whether it was through manifestations. Well, we go beyond, we don't...
Or music. Orphic chants, the Orphis rituals were
about.
So
there was
music.
A much earlier global language, a navigational language that was shared by the thinkers of many of the diverse cultures, using mathematics, using astrophysical symbols, as well as musical cues.
But I think that language put us in touch with higher realms of intelligence, which the Tower of Babel, we're told, of course, in a biblical scenario, actually cut our contact.
Well, I think the Tower of Babel was cutting the contact telepathically.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
But Omar, what does your research reveal for this discussion?
What I've thought about the Tower of Babel was that it's more of a metaphorical story where this, you know, our ancients are telling us that at some given time, we all spoke the same language, and that language was the language of thought. And then when the connection was severed, you know, we know that there's like tens of thousands of different tribes all over the world speaking oral languages, which is, you know, a dialect to their own, you know, to their own regional areas. And I think what the confusion was is that when that psychic or telepathy was severed, it was at that time the confusion set in upon our people, which created, you know, disharmony amongst all of us globally. And I think that's how people were communicating prior to the Tower of Babel, when they were in South America, communicating with people in Asia or in Australia or in Africa or wherever you may be. So I think that has a lot to do with consciousness and the, you know, and severing the link of consciousness. And, you know, I would even go as far as to say that it was an extraterrestrial intervention after, you know, the Younger Dryas impact, when that happened and when the melt-off began. I think there was an intervention at that time to keep us in this laborious state of mind and in this state that we are in right now to, you know, really keep us in that fight or flight, you know, set of mindset.
Well, maybe I want to, because that fits in with what Manu has discovered about these older texts, these really ancient, not just ancient Egyptian, but really ancient Egyptian texts, where there's a whole different language. Can you talk about that, Manu, where you think from the Hall of Records, there was this other, not even hieroglyphic, it was a previous language that you discovered?
So this is enigmatic writing in hieroglyphic. This is not, I'm not the one who discovered it, but I am, this is a young field, and so it's wide open. And what I basically used what Egyptologists have described as a technique, I used the knowledge of that to find hidden meanings in some of these texts. And so this is in the book Under the Sphinx.
Wait, there's the ancient hieroglyphs, which is and then there's enigmatic writing, which is
it's related. No, it's enigmatic writing in its very early expression is basically a phonetic mimicry, right? So you have a hieroglyphic text. For example, in the pyramid text, there is a mouth opening ceremony. It's on the northern wall of the burial chamber. And embedded within that text, phonetically speaking, there is a ritual called the statuette making ritual. But you wouldn't know that if you just read the text literally, right? It doesn't talk about a statuette. It doesn't talk about the carving of it, the painting of it. But phonetically embedded in the words that are used to describe the mouth opening ritual are the trigger words that will bring into awareness a memory of the statuette making ritual. And this is something that Egyptologists, by the way, themselves discovered. This is not something that I am proposing. Egyptologists themselves are saying that this exists. And so this is kind of a language within a language. And that takes me back to the skill that I was mentioning. So a masterful, skillful linguist, so to speak, a spirit in the netherworld learned those skills, how to use that hidden language to his or her advantage in order to be able to make it through the trials and tribulations of the underworld.
Some call it the book of breathings or intonations. And Dr. James Breasted at the University of Chicago, who set up the whole Oriental Institute, suggested that there were a meta language or a hidden language system that could not be figured out or understood that seemed to be connected.
Right. It's called Heka. So the Egyptians had a word for this. It's called Heka.
Right.
That's the name of this technique.
I'm so excited about your findings because it confirms what we, Desiree and I, have suspected about certain aspects or cues of the divine feminine that was there in ancient Egypt.
As a lioness, but talk then about the connection to the Hall of Records and where do you think that came from and what is in there?
Right. So the way I got even, I wasn't looking for the Hall of Records. I was basically trying to find evidence to date the Great Sphinx, you know, which, as you know, Robert Schock and Robert Bouval, years ago, they presented geological astronomical evidence to show that the statue is much older. And so I was interested in that aspect of it. And so I ended up, by accident almost, looking at a painting that could not possibly have come from the ancient Egyptians. And so this in the book, I basically interpret the painting. It shows the heliocentric solar system, which the ancient Egyptians didn't know. And part of the interpretation of the painting involves a text that's written around it. And that text uses Heka. And so this is the connection, Alan. So the skill, the Heka skill, and again, I want to emphasize, this is something that Egyptologists acknowledge exists. So I did not come up with Heka. This is a technique that they themselves have discovered and described. And so using that what I've learned, basically, I had to teach myself, of course, how it works. And I'm by no means proficient, but I use that technique to basically read that text around this painting. And that was one key element in what eventually ended up taking me to the Hall of Records, because that painting it's not possible that this comes from the Egyptians themselves. This had to be some inherited knowledge. And so what that means is that there was in fact an archive under the Sphinx, the real archive, the real Hall of Records, and that archive was unsealed. It was broken open long time ago. So this is, of course, contrary to what Edgar Cayce predicted, because he said that the chamber is still sealed. But so what I found is that that chamber must have been opened and what was inside leaked out. And that painting was part of the content that leaked out. And so this is how I got to the chamber.
I mean, it could have been broken open and sealed back up, which means...
Yeah, right. What I'm saying is originally, the first time opened much, much... Right. Earlier, so I'm saying this had to be before Narmer conquered the north. So we're talking before 3000 BC.
Before 10,000 even BC, right? Because the Sphinx is old.
Well, it had to be before, sometime before. I can say, based on what I found, sometime before 3000 BC. Now that could it be earlier than that? Of course, but what we're saying is of that archive was put down sometime in 10,000 BC, because that is how old we're all saying the Sphinx is. So when the Sphinx, the original monument was a lioness. So the lioness was made in order to symbolically protect the archive. And so we're saying that happened about 10,000 BC. And so it was sealed in my reconstruction, and Sundheim opened approximately 3000 BC or maybe earlier than that.
And so one more thing that I think you make the point of in your book, and other people said, the face we see now, Neil, on the Sphinx is recarved from the lioness that was originally there.
Right. And we have a name. The lioness was Mehit. And so we have textual, I have textual evidence that this lioness existed, of course, before Khafre, before 4500 BC, and there's written proof of it. So this is not something that you have to wave your hand. So we have the lioness in iconography. We have the name for the lioness,
which is what JJ put in the Keys of Enoch in 1973. Was
the breast on the lion face, which originally was more of the female form. Mm-hmm. And this is work that took us back some 40 years ago when we were young scholars in Egypt. Is the acoustical measurements, what we felt were underground. Eventually, with friends of Robert Schock, we were able to probe in the early 90s and discover that underneath the Sphinx, there was a chamber, which you allude to, is something before 4,500 years ago, before the dynastic period. Mm. There were archives of knowledge sequestered in various parts of Giza, one of which was under the Sphinx, which was connected, what we believe to be an inner chamber, which was used for study and for certain forms of theological affirmation of connection with the imperishable stars, Imsak. Mm.
So, Paul, doesn't that go to the dialogue of Plato, Crito, where Plato's uncle Solon talks to the ancient Egyptians and they tell him that yes, there was a great race. Well, at Plato's time, it was about 10,000 or 9,800 years before that time. So talk about that and what you think was brought from the Atlantean civilization to Egypt, if your research shows you that.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. It was one of the students of Socrates, who was a descendant of Solon. And Solon was a real historical figure. He was a legislator. And Solon is the person who had traveled and had been entrusted with ancient Egyptian knowledge. And when Plato says what that knowledge was, he talks specifically about the cycles of life on the planet and the fact that the planet goes through periodic resets, that there are cataclysms on a planetary scale so great that it virtually takes civilization on Earth back to a zero, and then there has to be a regeneration. And he even puts some time frames on this as well. Plato, where the knowledge of the Egyptians and Solon ends and Plato's contextualization starts is not absolutely clear, but there's a point at which Plato goes on from there, and I've just lost my thread as to where I was going.
We're talking about
it
cycles.
To do with what causes the cycles. That's right. And he said that in large part, it's the object movement of objects in space that triggers these cycles.
Right, exactly.
And the way he talks about objects in space is it could possibly mean the movement of what we would call planets. It could mean the movement of objects like the moon, the capture of the moon by planet Earth in the ancient past, or it could mean bombardment by asteroids. In our modern frame of understanding, it leaves all that open. But what that does is that it puts the history of civilization into geological time to think in those terms, which is something that's quite foreign for us in our culture to be hearing about. We think we can trace civilization back to perhaps.
So the Giza industrial complex, we go into our research with other geologists and archaeologists using ground penetrating radar. We came up with an artifact, which I had analyzed privately with NASA scientists in Los Angeles. It was a piece of synthesized crystal that had a strong gamma ray radiation. We're talking about an artifact that goes back more than 5,000 years, being a superb example of crystal synthesis, as well as a gamma ray energy source. So the NASA scientists were perplexed. How do the Egyptians have these artifacts? Well, in our research, Egypt and the pyramids and Sphinx area served as an archive of where knowledge was brought in from various parts of the ancient world and sequestered underground.
Yes.
And someone mentioned the younger Dryas. And yes, I mean, that was a period of time from about 13,000 years ago to about 2,000 years, where it's interesting, the southern hemisphere was actually getting warmer while the northern hemisphere was getting colder. And there was a massive North American and South American extinction, even in recent times, which is amazing, that we used to have literally lions bigger than the African lion in North America. And we used to have mastodons, you know, these big elephants and all this, and even horses. And these have all gone because clearly there has been major cycles that had taken place on this planet. And we do feel, you know, if Atlantis was in these areas, that the people from Atlantis may have traveled to a better part of the planet to be able to spur the next civilization.
And bring their knowledge and maybe deposit records. But, you know, go ahead.
One of the hints at what that knowledge might have been that I find very interesting, because I think what you're saying, Desiree, is quite right about the migration of Atlantean knowledge has to do with the manipulation of metals. And Plato doesn't unpack what they were doing with those metals. But when we, in our modern Western framework, hear that, we think, oh, okay, that means physical technology, obviously, you know, metals for making machines, so on and so forth. But I think the clues are, if you look at the esoteric traditions, through history, that the metal technology that came from the Atlantean civilization may have had more to do with the use of metals to assist or support or manipulate human consciousness.
Maybe.
We agree with that in the sense that we do feel that the Great Pyramid was a center of initiation, but we actually feel that it's a dual use purpose. And that's what our new book is about, Giza's Industrial Complex, because we feel that they actually were able to use a type of anodes and cathodes, which are parts of a energy device, to take water, even salt water or fresh water, and actually produce gas, which would allow them to bring in their technology. We go into this in a deeper sense here, but I also just want to say that, you know, it doesn't put out the fact that these areas were key parts of higher initiation.
A school of the gods, so to speak. In layman's language, Egypt was a place where all of the great poets, mathematicians, and scholars, if they could migrate, there would be charmed by these magnificent artifacts. And we got pictures.
Here's a battery, just an example. This is what they feel is underneath the ground by El Fayoun. And it's like 3,000 chambers. Now, that doesn't make any sense unless it was literally a battery-operated system to produce the technology. And water is found everywhere. That's the biggest
underground problem. Hydraulic systems that we uncovered.
Well, I want to talk about these cycles of history. And, you know, Manu was recently at Göbekli Tepe, I think last year, maybe it was 3 years ago. And they, according to Paul, they maybe knew that these cycles and times were coming, and the whole temple complex, whatever that was, seemed to be buried, right, Manu? What did you discover?
Well, I want to tie something together. There's a couple of open ends I want to tie together. So Paul mentioned cycles of time, and you ask about the Sphinx. So in The Message of the Sphinx, this is a book by Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval, late 90s, they were proposing exactly that the Giza Plateau is basically a megalithic processional clock that you can rewind back to Zeptepi by basically aligning the three stars correctly with the three pyramids, and by aligning Leo at due east with the Great Sphinx. So I wanted to just mention that. So that's one aspect. The other aspect that I also started reading your book, by the way, Dr. Hertak, about this idea of a closed system, right? And the laser pattern that you cited. And so this reminded me of something that Robert Bouval wrote in Cosmic Womb. That's a book he published a couple of years ago, 2017. So he basically was considering one way that the design of the Great Pyramid could have come to the architect if the architect, let's say, was an Old Kingdom Egyptian, it could have been by a download. So it's kind of a conscious stream, Alan, in the sense that you mentioned it, you know, James Joyce's stream of consciousness or Akashic record tap in, whatever you call it. And so the architect downloaded this, but did not completely understand the purpose of this blueprint. So they basically built a Great Pyramid, but it didn't function as the design was designed, the design was meant to do.
I think so.
That kind of reminded me of what you wrote in your book, Dr. Hertak, that this, that the system of the chambers reminded you of a closed system. I think you mentioned it's a laser, it's a hydrogen laser system, right? And you quoted the patent and you showed the diagram of the patent, and then And then you basically compared that to the chamber system of the Great Pyramid. And you said that you're not saying that the Great Pyramid was made to be a laser, but you sort of felt like the design, the blueprint resembles that of a modern design. And so this kind of, you know, I just wanted to tie all these things together, you know, to take this back to the main idea of the conference is, you know, portal to ascension.
I wanted to congratulate you on your book because this coordinates a lot of missing pieces. It collaborates a lot of missing pieces that we've been working on, suggesting that there was an earlier generation of scientists or pre-scientists that understood the Giza Plateau was a type of ground zero for measuring the precession of the equinoxes, but also giving us mathematical distances and cues between our planet and the sun and other situations, which would take about 30 generations of Einsteins, one after another, to do all the calculations, unless there was a higher universal source of energy that was, so we say, downloading this into the minds of very clever thinkers.
Actually, Neil's doing a whole pyramid conference, right, Neil? You want to jump in there and talk about, you know, the genius of, did you have something?
No, I just wanted to say that what Manu is saying is very important, that the understanding of the higher symbology of the ancient text is pointing to a much larger story than just Egypt proper.
Right.
Cycles of creation and creativity that we can energize and actually adapt to for our free energy sources.
That's why I mentioned Göbekli Tepe, but, you know, Neil is going to highlight the whole discovery
And we knew Dr. Schmidt, who was at Göbekli Tepe, the German archaeologist.
And we also visited a Göbekli Tepe, which is an amazing area. It's right by the area of Ur. So that's also a sacred region.
Going back some 15,000 years, really three times the historic classical period of Egypt.
Well, let's hear.
Or though the birthplace of Abraham.
Well, they think that Abraham's right there. I went with, you had to go, the women on one side, men on the other, and they think that that's
also not far from where the Ark supposedly had landed, and so that was a really ancient. And Göbekli Tepe, if people don't know, is a place in Turkey that's been discovered.
I'm picking up on three things you're saying there, because all those three references are about pivots in human history.
That's right.
Which three are you naming then?
So you mentioned Göbekli Tepe, Abraham, the Ark.
Yes. What are these pivots to in your understanding?
Well, the Ark represents the extinction of a previous civilization and the birth of a new one. Okay. Abraham is the birth of a new civilization. In the Hebrew tradition, Abraham is the progenitor of the tradition that results in the Jewish tradition. Right. If we connect Abraham and Sarah with Brahma and Saraswati in the East, they are recalled as the progenitors of human civilizations. So Abraham may be an even more important figure than we've traditionally understood. So you've got Abraham is a reset, and the way he appears in the Hebrew canon as it is, Abraham appears in a brand new world after a previous one has been destroyed and decimated in Genesis 11. Mm-hmm. And then Göbekli Tepe is very intriguing indeed, according to exactly how we date its burial. But where it is, the fact that it's just down the road from Karakadag, to my mind, hints at the possibility that Göbekli Tepe is at the tail end of a previous civilization, that there may have been a deliberate nurturing of the new civilization just down the road from those who are curating Göbekli Tepe.
That makes sense.
And it may have taken the previous civilization, and this is just me thinking out loud, really, a while to realize that this really was the pivot. They really were on the way out. And that's why the burial of Göbekli Tepe was as late as it was. Yeah. But nevertheless, those three moments that you mentioned, they are moments in human history.
The establishment of the lioness in Egypt over the Hall of Records was another pivot in civilization, which was really the foundation, I think, of the modern world that, you know, went from that whatever civilization that was, to the ancient Egyptians, to the Greeks, to the Mediterranean world, along with the Judeo-Christian knowledge, you get the Greco-Roman history. So we get that merging, but starting right there, I think, Manu, with the lioness sphinx. So,
there's a specific reason for that, and I'm glad you're bringing this up, because the lioness actually was intimately associated with writing. And so I just wanted to emphasize this, because what Paul just said, you know, he's talking about the two pivots, Abraham and Göbekli Tepe. So what Robert Schock and I think is that Göbekli Tepe actually presents a very important seed of civilization, which is writing, early writing. So we think that the symbols on the pillars are logos, which is that is basically the quintessential concept of Abrahamic religion, right? That you basically get rid of icons. That's the story of Abraham, right? He challenged Nimrod, and Nimrod, you know, threw him down the mountain. And so Abraham survives. And from that, he basically resisted icon worship. And he's saying, no, God is an idea. It's the word. It's not an icon. It's not a statue and all of those things,
it's part
right?
of it's a higher language. We call it celestial or formative logos.
So this is the pivotal moment in civilization creation, is that you go from worshiping, you know, material things to an idea, the idea of God, the intellectual creation, right? And so this is how the religions get created. And that is exactly the same idea with the Great Sphinx and the lioness, because the lioness ends up being the protectress of the writers, right? It's the this is unfortunately underappreciated. When you look at the earliest records that we have, you can't separate the lioness from the Writers Guild, because in all those ceilings, and I show this in the book, is you see a writer's tent, the early administration of the Egyptian state. And in front of that writer's tent is the lioness. You can't separate the two ideas. And so why is that? Well, it had to do with how the Egyptians conceived of writing. It was basically an act of hunting in the netherworld after the shadows of the deceased.
Wow.
Okay. And in order to hunt, the shaman had to go into a trance. And Paul, you brought up psychedelics. So this is what we think happened here as well. The shaman was basically in some kind of self-induced trance. He was going into the netherworld and he was hunting after the shadows of the dead, and he was using animal spirits as help to find these shadows. And the quintessential animal spirit huntress is the lioness, right? So the lioness was helping the shaman to retrieve the shadows, bring them back into the world, and then imbue them into a statuette and to animate the statuette and bring back the memory of that dead person. And that's what writing is basically, right? You're bringing a shadow, an outline of a symbol, and putting it on papyrus.
Creative right? idea, the creative imagination.
That's right.
Of the shadows.
That's exactly right. So see, when James Joyce is talking about this the stream, when he imitates the stream of consciousness, right, in Ulysses, for example, that's what he's doing. He's basically putting on paper the creative engine that we all have. Right. When we go through a stream of consciousness, right, we think. And then when you actually put this into words on paper, you are creating, you're turning it into a reality. Right. That's what writing really is.
Right. And so being the fan here, it really is the creative substance. I also like, though, to equate the power of the lion or the lioness with the solar system, with the sun itself. But I agree with you, like Diana, the hunter, in Greek mythology.
I also want to go back, the idea of the stream of consciousness is how he started his last book, Finnegan's Wake. He starts with River Run, and it's in the middle of the sentence that starts at the end of the book. So you get the cyclical nature of the stream of consciousness. But of course, you can never step into the same stream twice.
Yeah.
Of course,
you're absolutely correct. I mean, the lioness is an equinoctial marker, right? So that kicks me back to what Paul was saying about cycles of time. That is the ultimate you know, the number 12 on your hour clock, right? That's basically the best way to start and end. I mean, to use as a marker to track time, right? It's basically due east. Mm-hmm. And so that's what, yes, that's what, of course, the statue is also a marker of time. Yes.
Because it looks due east, actually. So Omar, yes. Does this fit into your cosmologies and what you've been studying over all these years?
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking while Manu was talking about the lion, and I spoke to a number of guests that have been researching Mars, and there's like a huge, huge lion, which is on Mars. So I'm wondering what connection the lion on Mars would have anything to do with Mars and the protection of writing here on Earth.
JJ was one of the first to find the face on Mars, identify it as well as the pyramids on Mars. He actually puts this into his 1973 book long before, what was his name, Richard Hoagland. Mm-hmm. Well, not long before, but before Richard Hoagland pointed out the face on Mars. So is there a relationship between
Mars, especially the pyramids on Mars? That's what we really talked about. Dr. Jack specifically talked about.
I was a consultant at Jet Propulsion Lab, and I had seen through a higher state of consciousness, pyramidal and geometric forms on the surface of Mars, which I told my colleagues about. They sort of put it to the side, thinking it was insignificant. But when the Mariner 9 probe actually showed pictures in clear detail, I had the permission to publish. Not only did I publish the major and minor pyramidal grid systems that have never before been seen at that time in 73 in the Keys of Enoch, but I also alluded to the female forms that would also accompany the Sphinx face. And that was illustrated by a colleague who had worked also in the space community, suggesting that there was an earlier cycle of history where the mother of the heavens known as Nut, mm-hmm. Egyptology, in the symbolism mm-hmm. of Eastern and Near Eastern religions, it was clearly understood the matriarchal or the female symbol preceded that of the male.
Does that have anything to do with Mars and writing?
It definitely has so difference in the artifacts themselves. The artifacts speak as a language of symbols to a higher civilization that was there before Mars lost its atmosphere.
And we work with the Zulu shaman Kredo Mutwa, and he believes that his whole tribe of the Zulus actually came in Maracaiba, is what he says.
From Mars. So. At the time of a great planetary cataclysm.
Yeah, because the cataclysms not only just take place on this planet, they also had taken place on others.
But in the Zulu tradition, mm-hmm. it's the Divine Mother is pictured with this face of the female and the headset of a mm-hmm. space goddess or traveler. So it was clearly embedded in the consciousness of the ancients that the Divine Mother, the symbol of the heavens, preceded all history. It was there, and it was recognized also in the lioness figures before the Egyptian, the Indian, and even the indigenous temples.
So it's interesting, we're talking about all these pivots in time, in civilization, in planetary history, and maybe there's something that remains to remind us, maybe to prepare for another pivot. I mean,
if I could mention, some great LIDAR studies, which is light-induced radar detection, has gone on in the area of Tikal, Guatemala, and also recently in Angkor Wat. And they found that these areas, Angkor Wat, Cambodia, right? Not a lot of people. There used to be almost a million people at the time of the building of Angkor Wat. You go back, they found that now, but looking at these radar studies around the area, go back to Tikal, which is officially part of the Yucatan, they call it Petén, and they believe that over 2 million, maybe even as many as 10 million, no one really knows, existed in all of the Yucatan. And what happened to this culture around 500 to 700 AD, because the culture goes back before the time of Christ, the whole area of the Yucatan, was the fact that they cut too many trees, this is what they think, and that they lost their water supply by 70%. Mm. So even in contemporary times, we're finding similar problems that had taken place. I just want to say one other thing regarding Orion, because that's very important in our cosmology, that what you see in the Great Pyramid of Alpha Draconis on one side, Thuban and everything, and Orion on the other, they have the same cosmology in the Mayan culture, according to Linda Shelley, where Orion was considered one of the father figures, and the three hearths, stones that they put in their hearth was considered part of an offering to the father or the gods connected with Orion. So you have a real link between Orion of the Mayans and Orion.
So we did the official musical studies with permission of the Ina people in the government of Mexico and also in Egypt. We were the only group allowed because we were all professional physicists, musicologists, and remote sensing experts to do the official studies, both in Egypt and in Central America, to show that history reinvents itself through a higher state of consciousness. Mathematics, music, vibratory science, they all interconnect in patterns that are not simply indigenous or related to one group. It's a worldwide understanding and exercise of consciousness expansion.
And we wouldn't limit it to this planet, actually. That was the whole point of
why was the pyramids on Mars?
But Dr. Hardak, I just want to quickly go back when you were speaking about Krita Mutwa. Krita Mutwa talked about the two Chitahuri brothers. Would that have anything to do with the pyramid on Mars or even the face on Mars compared to here on Earth?
I had quite a look at the pictures of Mars before I published it in my book called The Keys of Enoch. As a shaman and also a brilliant artist, he was able to say these were not the artifacts of nature. They were man-made because of the structures and details that he was able to find in related structures that were repeatable. Jacques Monod, the famous French biologist who got the Nobel Prize, said Mother Nature doesn't work in clear-standing forms that are repeatable. On Mars, you have just the opposite. You have clear-standing forms that are repeatable, hundreds of thousands of times larger than those structures at Giza, things that have been airbrushed out, so no one knows the true story of what's on Mars. But clearly, the indigenous tells us, even the Zulu, there was once a transmigration between souls from Mars to Earth and vice versa. So clearly,
and the two brothers, I mean, if you go back,
represent a dialectic
to the Egyptian, you have Set and you have Osiris. If you go back to the Guatemala in the Popol Vuh, you have the two brothers who actually play the ball game of life to the death.
So this means Babylonian Enki and Enlil.
So this means the new cosmology,
the same story
of our contact story with the extraterrestrials and ultra-terrestrials.
But what about this thing about cycles of history and civilization? Like if we go back to Göbekli Tepe, they knew something because they buried this huge temple complex. So
all these
like root races
really understood the cosmology of the heavens. And I think they saw these things coming in advance.
But that's why we're talking about this now, because maybe something is coming. Well, we have to prepare. Yeah, go ahead, Nick.
Let me comment on this. So when it comes to this, the cycles, right, we've obviously gone through cycles where we've probably been advanced civilizations and then had a devolution of consciousness. And it looks like we could continue having those cycles. But I feel that there is a way for complete liberation to maintain ourselves at this level of consciousness. And part of that will be uncovering the evidence of our ancient past that actually exists, that is hidden from us, is not taught to us, or is just not explored enough, right? Because say that the church, the Catholic Church, is in the way of an archaeological discovery that could blow the lid off a lot of information. They have a lot of evidence underneath the Vatican Church, for example, all the way to other components of the fact that the Sahara Desert is one of the largest areas in the world that's unexcavated and unexplored, but it was completely a lush land full of probably some ancient civilizations there. Right. So when we start uncovering these, discovering these, and getting it out to the masses, and we start learning what happened, and we understand that we can transcend linear time into this bigger cycle of time, then we can actually navigate existence like a template, right? Like kind of like astrology is. And we can even avoid cataclysms and create structures that sustain us during certain ages. So I feel that's how we can actually not be a victim to the cycle anymore.
Well, that's so important. No, it's our next cycle.
But it's also what you're trying to do, Neil, is put together all the pieces here. And it's interesting, as Paul said, there's these pivots, but also these like markers in time where they have not been totally forgotten. We've been talking a lot about the Shroud of Turin. That's another marker in time of quality of ascension that's possible. And so there's these cues from the past to the present that's directing us maybe towards a way of acting differently in the future.
And that's why we have this program, Portal to Ascension, because you, Anil, are bringing all of us together to examine through many years of field research the fact that we have information now that needs to be brought forth more evenly, transnationally, and on a level of a global commons that can let people decide for themselves, do we represent shall we say, a finding of an earlier chapter of history that would bring world civilizations together.
But what's important for the future really is a change of our way of looking at Mother Earth and the use of technology. That's why we came out with this book, The Importance of Hydrogen for Our Future Can Literally Save Us on This Planet. But there's also, of course, cosmic changes as this planet.
I just want to go back to what Manu said about what you may have discovered about the ancient Egyptians, and not just their cosmologies, but how did they live? And because they were able to maintain a kind of continuous civilization for 10,000 years, and we can barely make 200 years in this country. So did they know something that, I mean, I guess all these civilizations knew something we've forgotten, but what do you think they knew and the civilization that Göbekli Tepe knew? Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a question I'd like to answer with something that Klaus Schmidt published about 11 years ago. So he was trying to interpret the meaning of Göbekli Tepe. And one of the models that they developed was that it was basically a way to overcome clan thinking, right? So they called this totemism. So because each enclosure had its own animal motif, so Klaus Schmidt proposed that this represented a different clan, and they were able to all come together at Göbekli Tepe and overcome their differences, because they basically looked up to a higher ideal that transcended all of their differences. And when you're asking what is the message that the ancient people may pass forward to us, I think that's exactly what we need today, is because we are so divided and we are so focused on our differences and we're fighting. It's a very partisan sort of atmosphere that we live in. And what Neil just said was very important. He's saying, if we want to overcome the challenges of environment and the threats from the outer space, we have to come together and become inventive so we can come up with something that Desiree just mentioned, you know, using hydrogen as a fuel source. And in fact, just recently, Stanford scientists have developed a way to make hydrogen gas from seawater. Okay, this is a major advance, actually. You know, it doesn't come out in the news, but look at how much time and brain power it took to come up with something like that. And that's what Dalai Lama is saying. So I have a good friend who's just met with the Dalai Lama recently, and the Dalai Lama is saying, this is the biggest challenge that we're facing, is that we need to combine our mind power. We have to stop separating science from esoteric thinkers, right? So, you know, we're sort of, I guess we fall into the category of esoteric thinkers, but then we have the classical scientists and academicians. And what the Dalai Lama is saying is that we need to all get together, because the academicians have lost a little bit of their polymaths, of the heretic, you know, they're too focused on reason and plausibility. And we, on the other hand, you know, we're not afraid to investigate this highly esoteric stuff. And if we all came together, then we might be able to solve these problems. And that's, yes. I think, if you're asking what is the message of the ancients, Alan, I think that's exactly what it is, that they were able to overcome these differences with their monumental building. And that's what we need to do.
And also, it seems like if we are going to go out into space, the one thing that we have to do is come together first as a civilization, because they don't want the divisions. They don't want the nuclear energy in outer space. So I think that's really first and foremost. I'm a proponent of hydrogen, but ultimately we have to come together. So thank you for saying that.
Otherwise, it's going to be just a competition in space. And if we don't have collaboration, we're not going to get anywhere.
Right, we're going to be fighting the Klingons, right?
This is ourselves, really. Wait, so go ahead, Paul. Give us what you've gotten from this conversation.
I was just going to say that what we were just saying relates to the story of Socrates' life / Plato's life, and that is that he reached a point of exasperation and hopelessness with regard to political processes at a human level. And because he thought, should I be going more thoroughly into the world of politics so that we can achieve a better society? And he reached the point of thinking, no, that is just not going to work. And so what he did instead was to do what we were just saying, which was to bring together the scientific, which is reason applied and logic applied to things we all observe. That was one of Plato's main strands. And then the recovery of ancient knowledge, that was the Solon and Egyptian and Atlantean narrative. And then the experiments in consciousness, so that we can download other information that's available. he made a life decision to pull all those things together and offer them to the world as a gateway guy, as an alternative to investing all his hope into political processes.
They assassinated, they put him in jail for that, actually.
So we got the idea of a republic.
Instead of a dictatorship,
which is exactly the same idea, right? You have a government instead of a dictatorial government.
The Ahmadi text, the Coptic text, they found a copy of the Republic. So even the cloistered community, the Plato had the upper hand, so to speak, in terms of sciences. But the interesting thing is here, and I think I agree, I'm glad Paul is such a great classical scholar, is the higher thesaurus, treasury of knowledge that the great minds of the ancient Near East understood, and also from India and beyond, that we were just a schoolhouse of new souls waking up to the teaching of the divine Godhead. And we always had to push the envelope through a sense of seeing a much greater plan of coordinating music, science, the art, or what was said, the polymath mindset of seeing that we are, shall we say, denying ourselves the fullness of the mysteries if we limit this only through the microscope of Western science.
Right. That's why Neil always brings in poetry and music and sound. I mean, this is like what we can't say in words, Neil, you're putting out in musical vibrations, which which is the work of the Hertox too.
Yeah. So, I've always loved to, there's such huge teachings really in learning, understanding quantum physics, the fact that we exist in a subatomic world and all those. And I found out really early, actually, right when I was getting into this, that one of the best ways to convey all this information is in a spoken word piece, a poetry piece that takes people on a journey into this, this information. For the first 7-8 years of me doing this, 70% had no idea what I was saying. And even people who are in the spiritual community, only 10% of them knew because I was speaking it so fast. But I'll give you an example real quick. I went to England a couple years ago, and I went to 3 open mics in 3 nights in a row at bars, with just at nighttime at local bars. And no one understood what I was saying. But every time I would do it, I would get up and I had responses from people that they felt the frequency. So it's like the vibration of the word. What's that?
At the end, or maybe just insert as a little break here, just one about ancient civilizations and, you know, the mystery and
the whole thing was about that, you know. And I told them
we have a room full of people sitting with us in Sedona who would love to hear just a little break from the figuring out the ancient past, a little musical interlude.
But all right, let's do it.
Okay,
so this is one of my favorite ones. I've done this a lot. It's just, it was the first one I ever performed that a spoken word in 2008 when I met my wife. The road goes on for generations. The travelers will disperse their light amongst all the willingly incarnated souls. But what if the ones who didn't know? Amnesia of the internal endowment to reserve a place in the fifth dimension for themselves. The ego took control in a better life they shall never know. I welcome you, dark one, into the lap of luxury followed by pain and woes. We all sold our souls to the devil, but the devil exists not. Negative energy we dub as evil creates the demons of whom we are fearful. Take the D from the demon, put it in front of the word evil. Now you have a personified devil. Our thoughts and experiences create the creatures only exist in the mind. Our desires and wants create the full-featured ego that keeps our lower souls from reaching the divine. Intellect. Love and a perfect understanding we will have with one another. I welcome you, my brother, my sister, my lover, to become one, to help me become one, before reality tears me from duality and back in ether's imagination. You see, I'm the ghost of lives past. Generations have descended to gain these experiences, and I pray the human situation is critical, mind analytical. Won't let me forget the fall of angels and demons into the third dimensional world. Is this planet yours? May I hide amongst the lost souls? Hide out for a bit, drink some liquor, smoke some weed, and step outside for a cigarette? Yeah, sure, man, here's a social security card. You may live. Reincarnated a kid to live and give back to the society when I'm locked in borders, I smolder, but through the ashes comes a horde of abstract thought. Who is not a ghost, a spirit, but just is an enlightened individual. Equality minus the elitist political goal, the cynical flow, the pain and woes, and shamanistic pagan ritual woes. We will resurrect the Messiah in all of us. It's time to trust our brothers and sisters. unity of mind, conscious awareness on the rise, the yin yang intertwined, masculine feminine lovers intertwined, spit worse than the chakra points in my spine, relentless but still fine, inner peace up on the place of my corrupted mind, chemtrails, aspartame, fluoride, kept my awareness fried, getting drunk and high, about to cause question, why am I really here? But now I know is to help humanity steer into the right direction. For every single one of you, I feel affection. We're in the same situation. So erase the awkward moments, trying to walk around and get that bonus. Remember, the Arcturians will be one of the group of interdimensional beings in the near future. The mass landings will help us all really breathe. So raise your frequency if this is what you want to see. And don't try to break free from the shackles of captivity that we formed in our own mentality, because you and I, we are, and we've always been free.
Wow, bravo.
Thank you.
Every time I hear MC Resonance, I get goosebumps on the hair on my arm just stand up, because the vibration is just so intense.
That sort of sums up what we're trying to say here, Neil. Like, cycles of history will go on and on as we seek our own inner freedom, and we build these monuments to these unseen gods and beings. And it's really about some inward journey that we maybe are in a never-ending cycle to discover the mystery. That's us. The mystery. Yeah. That's
Neil, I have something interesting for you. Jean-Paul Bouval and I recently found an interesting bridge between the Great Pyramid and Sanskrit poetry.
Mm.
You know what it is?
What?
Fibonacci numbers.
Okay.
Right? So yeah. it turns out that Sanskrit poetry, the way that the syllables were aligned, used the Fibonacci relationships, right? So 5 and 8, for example, that's how the syllables were mixed, like the short and the long syllables, right? I forget what they're called. Mm-hmm. And so what we found, when you can actually create the entire interior design of the Great Pyramid with three simple concepts. One is the Fibonacci numbers, one is the Horus numbers, and one is the 2-to-1 triangle. So with those three architectural themes, we were able to recreate the entire interior architecture. And that, of course, goes back to vibration and resonance, because Fibonacci numbers, right? They basically, it's a low integer type of resonance that you get. And so that might explain why people have these interesting experiences inside the Great Pyramid, because it was designed based on these metric numbers, right? That Sanskrit poet used to create this rhythm. Like you had an interesting rhythm. You changed your rhythm a few times when you did your poetry, right? And I think that's probably why also you can remember all those words, because that's amazing that you can remember all of that. But because you're adding a rhythm to it, right? I think that's probably part of why you can remember it.
Yeah, definitely. And can I find out more about that work? How can I find out more?
Yeah,
about
it's on my YouTube channel. Yeah, okay. We have a paper, but the video, and I have, and Contact in the Desert, I'll give a talk about it. I'm in the workshop.
And also, we have exemplified the same finding.
Well, that's right. I was going to say, in terms of ancient Hindu temples, one of the most sacred temples of the world is really the Cambodian Hindu temple of Angkor Wat. It got changed to Buddhist. Originally, it was Hindu, and it starts with the three and then goes to the five. It's one of the key places for the five. And the Aztecs also looked at the five. So going from the three to the five is key. And we feel that's one way of really anchoring the higher consciousness on the planet was done in that Fibonacci.
And if you go beyond the Fibonacci to the Tribonacci, even a more complex number relationship, you'll find certain patterns.
What's a Tribonacci?
That's right.
It's a certain mathematical unfoldment instead of it adds the three numbers.
Oh, three numbers.
And that explains many of the higher temples in mountainous regions where the soundscape seems to change to a higher elevation.
Well, the Temple of Hempe in India, which I've been to, their pillars are musical instruments. I've been there.
I'm going to present on that later today, actually.
Oh, great. And this is our work with musical linguistics. Manu knows this and probably is the best example of what has been hidden, which is the female soul that sings within us.
And so actually Angkor Wat also has a hall of echoes as well that does the sound. Chichen Itza has that. Tikal has that. Many places have this kind of echoing energy. Also China, some areas there, circular.
I wanted to ask Manu, what are the Horus numbers again? You did that in your workshop that I attended, but what are those Horus?
Yeah, it's serial halvings, right? So you get 1/2, 1/4, 1/8, 16, and then That, and then the cardinal numbers are 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64.
And is that synced up with the prime numbers, the Fibonacci cycle?
Yeah, not prime. We don't have any. We didn't find a prime theme. We found the Fibonacci numbers up to 144. And Jean-Paul Bouval recently found something amazing that further confirms it. So when you add up the first 10 Fibonacci numbers, you get 231. And the queen shaft, the two shafts that come out of the queen chamber that Desiree Hertak just mentioned, that point to Sirius, right, on the south side. So it turns out that you can actually recreate the angle of that shaft by taking half of that, 231 divided by half, you subtract the king chamber, and that is exactly, then with Fibonacci 89, that takes you exactly where that shaft is going. So we were able to actually recreate the angle off the shafts with this simple, very easy to remember Fibonacci numbers. It's incredible. And so it's not just the numbers, but it's the sum of the 10 numbers that gets you those shafts, which is further proof that that was used with intent, right? So yeah, it's just, I mean, we just keep discovering more and more layers of this. Yeah.
But it encodes us from the past to as a guide to the future, like how we can use that mathematics to duplicate connection to the stars.
It's actually the portal of ascension, right, for real.
It's a portal of ascension, right?
Yeah. You know,
they said the Great Pyramid with the mathematical understanding of all of the other angular concepts all balanced.
And how do we activate that portal?
By breath, by song, with what Manu said earlier, is the secret book of breathing in the hieroglyphics on the walls, the ability to breathe in and to vibrate certain sounds in a certain sequence,
which is
of memory into open higher consciousness. This is what created the golden rays of light that appeared within the Great Pyramid when we were there.
Right. And one of the things that we experienced in terms of sound was in the King's Chamber, we found that it's not the overtones that are significant, but actually if you're singing, especially a male voice, I hate to say that, but it is a male voice, it actually brings you into undertones, which puts your brain in a heavy alpha frequency state, and that's where people start having experiences. So the sound is part of that.
So Paul, do you get some of that from actually the connection between Plato and Pythagoras and the whole ancient Greeks and how it goes back to Egypt
and the mathematics, right?
Yeah.
Well, actually what I was resonating with just now is the connection between breathing and ascension. And I got that from a completely different start point personally, and that was from Eastern Orthodox hesychasm. And that's a tradition that's more than 1,000 years old of controlled conscious breathing. And I learned about it through one particular practitioner of it, who was a Russian mystic hermit monk who lived from 1759 to 1833, called Seraphim of Sarov. And Seraphim was the name he was given when he was professed as a monk. And it turned out to be rather prophetic, because through decades of practicing controlled conscious breathing, he had a number of experiences where he started emanating light himself. And there were eyewitness accounts of this happening. And so I learned all this about this fellow when I was in the thick of ministry, and my whole paradigm was just a Christian paradigm. Now, as I've done more research more lately, I realize there's a far bigger context to hesychasm, and that controlled conscious breathing is part of traditions all around the world. And sometimes the breathing is associated with toning and chanting, and sometimes it is just pure breath. But it actually achieves the same thing, and it is to do with altering our brain waves. And the fruit of that for my friend Seraphim was that he started perceiving beyond the five physical senses,
right?
Getting information from
monks floating and doing
other planes. Yes, that's right, exactly.
I just showed a picture of my experiences in Egypt by the ancient pyramids.
And this is also Mexico.
Or Mexico by the ancient pyramids, using sounds of breathing in the ancient Egyptian, Hebrew, Aramaic, and suddenly light appears.
Yes, that's right. So that's what the hesychasts would call uncreated light, acknowledging that it's coming from a realm beyond our four-dimensional realm.
JJ knew a guy called Man of Light where he would actually emanate. You saw this, right, JJ?
Yeah.
The guy emanated light from his body.
Yeah.
You actually saw that in person.
Yes.
What's
okay. In Brazil.
So we have like 8 minutes left, Alan.
8 minutes left.
But I want to show a slide and get some feedback on it, on this information here.
I just got one question.
Go for it.
That I find is it's hardly ever addressed, you know, by anyone. And I was wondering, we have the pyramid complexes, you know, like in Mexico and in Egypt and also in China that correlate the Orion the constellation. Now, we also have that very same grid of the Orion constellation and within the three pyramid complexes in Mexico, Egypt, and then one is offset in China. You know, any thoughts on that?
Well, it's you mentioned that earlier. Absolutely. It's a duplication.
Even the three mesas here at Hopi, they've attributed to the three stars of the constellation, that one offset. And as you mentioned, Mexico. We actually feel that the there was contact with higher levels of intelligence. If nothing else, the Egyptians felt that their soul went to Orion, that at least of the pharaoh. Mm-hmm. And again, the Mayans also thought that was the place of the gods. In terms of our cosmology, mm-hmm. we feel Orion, and we're on the Orion arm of our Milky Way, mm-hmm. we feel Orion is an open vortex mm-hmm. to other dimensional realities. And that's, so you not only go to Orion, but you go through Orion. This is some of the experience.
But the offset could be a duplication of the Fibonacci curve from 1 to 1 to 2. So you get that leap.
Right.
And, you know, and it gets getting smaller.
For the global constellation of like Mexico, Egypt, and then China, because we have that one line.
We were in northern Syria doing work years ago, and we found out through measuring devices that with the pyramids of Mexico and China come together in Syria.
But Egypt definitely has the Fibonacci sequence when you count
on the Giza Plateau.
Yeah, on the plateau, mm-hmm. yeah.
So you can count the other smaller pyramids and it goes. So, but to just wrap it up, I guess, Neil, let's just go through everyone and just kind of leave us with really what we can learn from ancient civil. Oh, you were going to show something, Neil, right?
Yeah, I was going to show it, but maybe.
No, show
we can
it.
Do another time. Okay, so anyways, this slide right here. Part of my slideshow, it actually shows the position and the orbit of our solar system around the Milky Way galaxy.
Right. Those are not just all in the same galactic plane. I think those arms go up and down.
Yeah, yes, yes. So
also
from
what Billy Carson said, the impulse of these Sagittarius
dwarf.
Yeah, so check it out. That's actually
a different angle to our solar plane than the galactic plane.
Yeah, but yes.
This is really interesting, I think.
So I would say they also found Boates, Arcturus, is coming into our plane. They're finding that our Milky Way is eating up the Sagittarius dwarf. Now, he alleged that some people think that we came from there. Most scientists will not say that we came from the Sagittarius dwarf based on the amount of iron
is that the angle of our solar plane, which is pretty flat, meeting the level ground of the galactic plane, which is about 40 something degrees,
right.
Which shows that it's not of the same galactic sphere.
But let's just say this. The entire Milky Way is not a safe place on a regular basis.
Really?
To
I
live.
Love it.
The Keys of Enoch explained that Sagittarius is really the source, the mothering.
But that's right. The center of our galaxy. But bottom line, really, from the data coming forth, it doesn't look like Sagittarius. We were from Sagittarius dwarf.
Well, could we be from the center of the galaxy, closer to the center, and then spiraled out?
Well,
is that a possibility?
But basically, it is interpenetrating our system, and it has and will affect our system. And it could be part of the comets and meteorites and everything else that comes through our system.
Which is also about the cycles of time and civilization
and
gets us back to where we sort of began.
Well, I want to make a quick comment about this. Every one of these sections here is talking about a different area of this galaxy that we're passing through and the different things that could have happened to Earth because of it. And this goes back to the original what Paul was saying about the positioning and the cycles of time, that not only are we going up and down of the galactic disk, even though maybe a flat plane isn't a great way to explain it,
right.
But we're also going through this bigger cycle right here that has so many different effects. So even if we have a 26,000 year cycle after 26,000 year cycle, just the fact that we're orbiting around this huge thing just creates even a unique experience within those cycles.
And this other interference from this dwarf galaxy kind of throws everything,
different. We're from Boatis, which is also interpenetrating our system. We feel that's part of the code because the Boatis was also ancient.
Was that
known
galaxy?
as a shepherd? And no, it's a constellation.
And the source of the Arcturians, who is one of the first legitimate extraterrestrial groups identified by Scottish and British astronomers privately. Now it's coming out publicly through the MUFON organization.
So we feel some of this is happenstance, some of this is cosmic and implanted, so to speak, but a lot of it is also a warning sign for all of us that we need to grow up and really exist more in the greater cosmos.
Right, and it looks like everything's pretty static, but we're really moving around our sun. The sun is moving around that galactic plane
in at a helical spiral.
Enormous speed. So we need a map to understand the future and what we're coming into as a cosmic civilization.
And we need more people like Neil to expand the global conversation.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Neil, for the great work.
Thank you, brother.
And any final words from you, Paul? Any last insights that you may have about what you've been studying for us?
I just like the what we were saying before about the need for us to be Renaissance people, to use that expression, that we can pull together the scientific, that we can combine that with working consciousness, and that we can combine that with listening to the prior knowledge that our planet has curated. And I think if we pool all those things together, then that's our best hope of actually achieving a level of ascension as a species.
Well, that's why we're here, to really understand, like put all the pieces together. So
exactly.
Where does your work, Leah and Neil? I think you should do a workshop with Manu, because
I'd love to. Yeah.
It's like, so Manu, what do you think about the future of civilization? If that's an easy question.
Well, I think what Paul just said, I think this, I second all of that. I think the major challenge is maybe not, you know, I think we can overcome the threat of natural disasters, of threats from outer space. We are, As a group, we are smart enough to figure out solutions, but that's the problem. We're not acting like a group. We're acting like the hunter and gatherers, you know, in the past when they were all splintered apart and scattered around, and they didn't really invent civilization until they were able to gather together and exchange ideas, right? For example, at Göbekli Tepe, places like that. And that's what we need to do. But the problem is that right now we're in a war, right? I mean, it's like we're in an information war. People are being, there's an inquisition, right? People are, we're being called fringe, pseudo-archaeologists, pseudo-this, pseudo-that, right? And so we're basically being brandished as crazy people. And then on this flip side, we are attacking the academicians at Quackademics, right? Like John Anton West used to say. And I think what we really need to do is to drop all of that and come together in the middle. So we may have to adopt some scientific principles, okay, like a scientific method. We may have to learn how to do that. And the scientists may have to take some esoteric ideas from us if they're testable. You know, and I have to say, I really enjoy this, the chairman of Harvard's astronomy department. He's gonna be at Contact in the Desert. He's exactly the kind of person I'm talking about. He's willing to come across to our side, you know, and talk about those things. He's willing to say, "Listen, okay, I heard you. So let's talk about this." And I think we should do the same thing. And I think the comments that Paul just made really encompass that idea.
Right. And JJ and Dr. Desiree, what do you
think? Well, we're opening a treasury of knowledge that it was the reformulating of life as we know it. Mm-hmm. We're stepping up to a whole new threshold of cosmic civilization. And I think it's important that we be humble servants of the greater humanity, of right. not being over-specialized, but see that this is an age of synthesis, an age of the spiritual and scientific meeting into a type of new spirituality or a higher paraphysical cosmology, where we are all side by side in this teamwork.
Right, and I just want to say that, of course, the Great Pyramid of Egypt is in a key location upon the earth, but there are also key locations all over the world, a global grid that we feel now is being understood, that's being activated, and let's all be part of that as we awaken to a greater consciousness.
So we must make contact with ourselves first before we make contact with the cosmic others.
Yes. Right, and making
I love that one.
And that's really what my friend here and your friend is all about. He's been able to take the first major leap forward and present to Marco Rubio and others and the big political debates to take seriously that we've got friends.
I really enjoyed your chapter, Alan. Really well written. I really enjoyed it.
That was my personal journey. But what I got from this conversation is that we really, like Manu said, and all everyone, what's going to save us is pooling our resources, pooling our intelligence instead of the divisions, even what the government's not willing to tell us. Let's get it all out. Let's share it with the world. Let's forget about making weapons from this alien technology. Mm-hmm. Let's make peace from this. Let's really go into the chance of an enlightened planet, a civilization that has free energy and abundance for all. That is possible with new technologies, and the only thing that's stopping us are these walls and divisions that, you know, have been kept secret, you know, religions and countries and boundaries and borders and all those things that divide us. I think we're knowing that we have one world, and that and all these pieces taken together is what's going to save us, so we don't become one of these ancient civilizations that someone stumbles upon and says, oh, but those
or we don't become like Mars.
You know, it's like we want this continuation.
So to simplify it, is the continuation of the Adam and Eve story.
Whatever that means.
The apple with each other. And we all see the common tree of life or wisdom and not confuse it with the tree of dualism.
Right. Mm. So we really are here to share resources.
Love that.
Portal. This is the portal to ascension. Because we're ascending as a culture, as a civil, as a planet, but only with all the pieces of the puzzle on the table that someone says, oh yeah, this piece fits here and this. And we need the scientists and the academics and the Egyptologists and all of them to look at everything. Because, you know, we're not crazy to think that civilization is older than 5,000 years. I mean, it's obvious for anyone who looks at the ancient pyramid structures. It's like, but you can't tell an Egyptologist that because they...
We're growing into that. 130,000 year-old mastodon bones in San Diego, you know, we'll say 20,000-year-old artifacts in Camp Monteverde in Chile.
Yes.
It's all very...
So I think that we need to just... have an open mind rather than what science seems to have become in many aspects, that this is what it is, this is what we know. But original science was philosophy. It was about really questioning and figuring things out and wondering and keeping open to it. You know, just 50 years ago we thought humans had only been, Homo sapiens were only on Earth for 100,000 years. Now it's 300,000 years. But now they're like, it's only 300,000 years. But hasn't the history of ourselves taught us to keep an open mind? Exactly.
Scientists to say, you know what? I don't know. And let's look at...
Let's explore it. Exactly.
Let's explore it. That's why I say about, you know, whoever these beings are coming here, let's go with, like, not belief. Do you believe in UFOs? Let's discover. Let's explore
what
these other worlds have for us. So thank you, Neil, for the opportunity to express and pull all these people together.
Thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in to Portal to Ascension Radio. Truly appreciate your time and your energy and just being here a part of this as we expand in consciousness and release more and more awareness so that we can really shift into a vibration that is in harmony for all of the planet and we can create true universal peace on Earth. And this podcast is just one of many platforms out there that are designed to do that. We're going to keep going with our series of presenters from our last Portal to Ascension conference that took place in 2021. Please do go to our YouTube, subscribe there. That's where we have most of our content coming out, youtube.com/portal to ascension. And then our Patreon, exclusive bonuses. If you want to support us in creating more content, we're creating so much all year, patreon.com/portal to ascension. And check out all the other social media platforms as well. Thank you all so much for tuning in. We're live every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday. Love you all. This is Neil Gore with Portal to Ascension. See you all later.